In May 1960, the Open Mind program will be 4 years old. Now, that's getting to be quite old, at least for a television program. And like any aging institution, the Open Mind is beginning to develop traditions. One of the traditions is this, that each year about this time, we take a close, hard look at that critical area in American life, civil rights. We now turn to that this week, and especially appropriately, because this today begins Brotherhood Week, sponsored by the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Our panel today, to my right, Mr. Herbert Ehrman, the president of the American Jewish Committee. In the center, Father John LaFarge, long associated with the Jesuit Weekly America, long associated with attempts to improve civil rights, and a man whom the Open Mind joins in saluting as he begins his 80th year. Across from me, Mr. Roy Wilkins, the executive secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Mr. Ehrman, may I turn to you first. As the head of an organization which has been so concerned with general human relations, in the panel discussing this subject last year, the men were generally optimistic about what they expected to happen in 59. Were your own expectations fulfilled?
I think so, Mr. Goldman. The past year was not sensational, but in my opinion, certain basic things happened. In the first place, the so-called massive resistance to desegregation collapsed in Virginia and in Arkansas, where they attempted to close schools that were to be desegregated. That form of resistance is now out. There are only 4 states now in the entire Union where there is not at least some desegregation, and those are the 4 states known as the Magnolia states of South Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi.
Excuse me.
That is one of the basic things. As we go along, I may mention some others, but that is one of them.
Father LaFarge, did the year live up to your expectations?
I might say that it decidedly lived up to my expectations. It went beyond them, but those expectations were very small. I didn't expect any very rapid progress. Of course, I look at the thing, this whole question, very much from, habitually, from the standpoint of a clergyman, Catholic priest, which means that I look on it very much, the question of the moral aspect of these things. Does the moral aspect of civil rights make a greater impression on people? And I think that's true. I notice around the country, the various religious organizations, Protestant and Jewish and Catholic, all of them seem to have taken much more interest in the matter, and a continued increase of pronouncements, and a great many smaller things that add up to the picture. So I think that we have definitely made progress, and the progress in many ways is, as Mr. Ehrman said, the massive resistance has broken down, which was one of the great bogeys we had in this whole matter. So I think there's been, in spite of all the handicaps, I think there is an improvement.
Mr. Wilkins, would you comment, please?
I would say that there has been definite improvement, and I want to join Mr. Ehrman in citing the collapse of massive resistance in Virginia and in Arkansas, because this, while spectacular in Virginia, is one of the great real movements to destroy segregation in the South. And I think it's much more significant than we're likely to think at first blush. For one thing, Virginia was the mentor of the South. And when the mentor devised a system that didn't work, then the rest of the South had to cast around. I think there are other reasons why the year showed improvement. There was this moral realization. The statement by the Atlanta clergyman was an outstanding and significant one. And then the resurgence of the question of the right to vote was another indication.
Well, now, on that right to vote, we have this important piece of civil rights legislation before Congress. I wish you gentlemen would discuss a bit, first, whether you think it will pass, and secondly, whether you think it will achieve its purpose if passed.
Well, as to your first question, Mr. Goldman, It seems almost certain that there will be civil rights legislation this year.
Would you care to predict the form it will take?
It will take the form of, in some way, what is sometimes called implementing the right of the of all people to vote. And whether it'll be through the courts and referees or through the president's executive power and registrars or a combination of the two, I don't think is too important.
Well, to clarify that completely, as I understand it, one plan calls for presidential-appointed referees.
That's right.
Another plan calls for federal court-appointed referees.
Yes.
And a third plan, that of Senator Hennings of Missouri, combines the two.
That's correct. And in this morning's New York Times, there's a very interesting article indicating that both parties are very eager to get the credit for civil rights legislation this year, and that's one of the reasons why I feel that we're certain to get a great improvement in the situation.
Wondrous things happen in an election year. Mr. Wilkins?
Well, Mr. Goldman, I was going to say that with reference to that last statement of Mr. Ehrman's, we're all hoping, we of the civil rights groups, hope that the scramble of the parties to get credit and to discredit the other party will not assume such magnitude that we'll lose sight of the legislation.
Mm.
Now, a day or two ago, the Republicans let loose an assault upon Senator Lyndon Johnson, designed to show that he had an anti-Negro voting record. Well, everybody knows that, and the only reason we fear its injection at this point is that it will hurt the collaboration of the parties on this legislation. We need both Democrats and Republicans to pass this bill. The Northern Democrats can't pass it by themselves, and the Republicans can't pass it by themselves. And so there's no point in throwing so many rocks at each other that you lose the bill.
Well, do you gentlemen who have been so long in this general field have any strong feelings as to which is the better plan, the presidentially appointed referee or the federal judge appointed referee?
Well, I'd rather not get into that.
You'd rather not.
Myself, it's a very complicated question. And if you include certain features of Mr. Rogers' proposal, you must include certain methods. For example, if you include state elections, you must have a court-based plan because the constitutional questions will arise. If you don't include state elections, then it might be well to go ahead with the registrar plan. But what we're after is a simple, workable, direct plan. And we're hoping that it'll come out. As out of all the formulas before the Congress now, there certainly ought to be one. And I wouldn't like to pick and choose here because I'm not that much of a skilled technician.
Well, to move to a somewhat different question here, there is another area of concern developing with respect to the Negro question in America. I notice more and more of it in the newspapers. It comes in part from the Southern sit-down effort at the present time, the lunch counter episodes, the spread of passive resistance as a technique, and the call for the immediate end of all types of segregation. That is moving into this larger moral sweeping area that you were talking about, Father LaFarge. Then, too, there is in the paper an increasing account of the growth of extremism among Negroes. Racial extremism in Harlem, the Times calls it, causing grave concern. The numbers of citizens there to whom the name NAACP is tantamount to waving a red flag in front of a bull. Negroes warning that the Negro masses will never again accept Uncle Tom leadership, which of course is meant the NAACP. And one gentleman saying the NAACP and the Urban League are doing a good job, but are not emotionally satisfying. They give out soothing words. When you're angry, you want to hear angry words. The question that's arising then is the NAACP keeping control of the movement with its essentially moderate program and with its essential desire to work through the courts, as I understand it, and to proceed step by step?
Well, that's a question which naturally belongs to Mr. Wilkins to answer.
I hope
he will, but I would like to say this, just to interject this idea, that the first place that this racism, this what you might call racism in reverse, is a natural phenomenon. I mean, you always have it. It'll always come, I think, through history. And it's, of course, a very dreadful thing. But I'm not surprised at it, because wherever you'd undertake to improve race relations, I'm not speaking just of the Negroes, but of any group, you'd always have people who of the minority group, of the injured group, who will be very angry and say they're not going fast enough. So it's not anything to be surprised at. If you try to help the people of any nationality, any minority, with the Catholics, or there'll be Catholics who say that you're not going fast enough, and so on. So it's a very natural thing that should be, and we've got to take that sort of thing in its stride. And secondly, that it isn't only here in our metropolitan situation, which is where this thing is erupting, is not merely a question of Negro.
Well, the nationalism is here. The sit-down is in the South, of course, or the sit-in, rather.
But you can have the problem is must be seen from a very wide basis.
Mr. Ehrman, I think I cut you off.
Yeah. There. Well. I agree with Father Lafarge that whether the particular question you asked concerning the NAACP should be answered by Mr. Wilkins. However, I do think that we are now touching upon a basic problem. Progress against bigotry and prejudice is made in several directions and through several forces. The action of government, which passes laws, and that in itself helps to delineate right from wrong and helps to educate people. The general progress of education itself, which in a way is the moral aspect which Father Lafarge mentioned, is perhaps of the most important. But it should not be overlooked that action has also a tremendous educational effect. The action of Gandhi in India, the action in Birmingham, in Montgomery Bus.
You see, but this
now,
Gandhi, excuse me.
Now,
yes.
What I was going to say is this, that the danger there is that type of action may get out of hand. And if it does, it may kindle itself into violence. And that is the great danger of action.
Well, now, before turning to Mr. Wilkins, I would like to clarify what I think is a growing concern of some people, namely that the passive resistance technique, first, is a much more radical technique, so to speak, than the NAACP technique, and secondly, that it is moving much more quickly than the NAACP had been moving into areas outside the strictly legal field, what might be called the social field. And this concern is reflected in the Times this morning in an article which is obviously pro-Negro, but quotes various Southerners who are supposed to be sympathetic with the Negro cause, saying that this is going to hurt the basic fight for civil rights. Would you comment, Mr. Wilkins?
Oh, well, they always say anything is going to hurt the fight for civil rights. It doesn't matter what you say or what you do. You say if you drink milkshakes instead of water, that hurts the civil rights fight. If you drink bourbon instead of milkshakes, why, that hurts the civil rights fight. Why didn't you drink milkshakes? A good deal of this, as Father Lafarge has said, is inevitable. It comes about in the struggle of any group for its a new status, and it comes about because the top group always resists. But to say that this or that thing is more radical indicates, I think, a lack of knowledge of the whole NAACP. I get a little weary of explaining over and over again that from its inception, the NAACP has been much more than a legal court action organization, and that a good many of the things we now talk about as new techniques were employed by the NAACP in years gone by. But of course, we've received our most spectacular, let us say, advertising over dramatic court victories, and so people pigeonhole us as a legal action group. The sit-downs in drugstores and lunch counters was successfully practiced by the NAACP and pioneered by us in this area 2 years ago in Oklahoma and in Kansas, where we won the fights. Our young people, our NAACP youth chapters, won these sit-down strikes in 39 or 50 drugstore chain in Oklahoma and Kansas. Well, now along comes somebody in North Carolina and sits down at a Woolworth store, and this is immediately a new technique. Why didn't the NAACP do this? As a matter of fact, our groups are active in this in North Carolina and South Carolina and in Virginia and Florida. But if people want to say this is radical and the NAACP is old-fashioned, I'll have to use some other time besides a half hour on the open mind to explain it.
Just to clarify this, you personally have no fear that this new technique is going to set back the NAACP fight for specifically votes and schools?
Oh, I have no fear at all, because this is a standard response of the opposition to every effort you make. If you make a soft effort, they say, why don't you keep quiet? If you make a hard effort, they say, why don't you make a soft effort? So I'm not worried about that.
Well, Mr. Goldman, I was going to suggest that we cannot rely on the passage of laws alone, that there has to be a general trend toward changing the entire atmosphere surrounding these questions. You know, one of the difficulties with passing a law, as useful as it is in its moral aspects and its educational aspect, we Americans are very much like the businessman who, when he gave his notes, he thought he'd paid his bill. And so we pass a law and we think we've settled something. We haven't settled anything, because it's still people who are going to conduct themselves, and they can nullify laws, and they can defy them. And unless you have, it comes from the inside, as Father Lafarge was saying, from a moral conviction. We haven't anything permanent.
Well, now, on this moral question, may I raise this question? A number of commentators are saying that the North, to shift from the South, that the North has not really developed any great moral indignation, or if it had it, is losing it. And they cite what is now being called by some people the resegregation process going on in northern cities, this resegregation by flight from the cities. The New York Times the other day gave ammunition to people of that sort when it ran a story saying that some Negro families found the schools now so bad in New York City, since the whites had fled, that these Negro families were sending their children to the South. This is obviously an extreme thing, and the highest estimate is 2,000, but it focuses the problem. Father Lafarge, this is particularly in your area. Has the northern sense of indignation about segregation become blunted in the last few years, in your opinion, as it faces the problems?
Well, of course, there was the old abolitionist sentiment, which petered out, of course, way back many, many years ago. And I personally have always felt that the mere sense of indignation is a very weak foundation for this whole matter, because indignation, after all, is an emotional thing, and can I think that the sense what you might call the Uncle Tom's Cabin sentiment, which in many ways as much harm as it did good, I think that's more or less a thing of the past. On the other hand, I think there is a growing understanding in the North among thinking people of the real bearings of this matter. It may not take the form of indignation, but takes rather the form of an intelligent understanding of what this whole matter means. Now, my view of the whole thing is that we never get anywhere in this whole question unless we keep clearly in mind two different things. One is without civil rights, without legislative protection, without the proper legal safeguards, our professions of charity and love are hypocritical. We tell our Negro friends or our Puerto Ricans or whoever they may be, we love them very much, but we're not going to bother about the homes they live in and houses they live in, or whether they're sufficiently protected. Then that's hypocrisy. And on the other hand, that guaranteeing civil rights, merely having legal protection is also insufficient, because there's always the element of the personal element, the element of personal contact and personal interest and so on. Now, a few days ago, I heard a very remarkable address made in sermon in St. Patrick's Cathedral and by Archbishop O'Boyle of Washington. and he brought out those two points, in my mind, in an extremely effective way. Archbishop Boyle, who's in a very key place there, the nation's capital, which has undergone all these tremendous changes in recent times, the 100% endorsement of the idea of legal protection, civil rights, and the need of legal safeguards for the civil rights, and so on. On the other hand, that is not enough, that we also have to have the personal approach, the sense of the personality of the people we're
with. Mr. Wilkins?
I was going to say, I want to go back to something you said, because it's, to my mind, a popular fallacy, and that is that the people in the North are fleeing the cities to get away from Negroes. Now, if we study the census figures for the last 10 years, we'll see a steady trend from the urban centers to the suburbs. Now, this has happened in New Orleans and Atlanta and in Richmond and in Miami and St. Petersburg and Jackson, Mississippi and Birmingham, and a dozen other southern cities have had just as great a trek away from the central city as New York or Washington or Pittsburgh or Detroit. This is an American trend to the suburbs. And to say that this is a favorite southern propaganda gimmick, that the northerners are running away from their cities and leaving them to the Negroes because they don't want to go to school with them, that's in order to prove their point. Well, they're running away from them in Atlanta, and they're running away from them in Birmingham, and they have no desegregation to run away from in Birmingham.
Well, Mr. Wilkins, two things. Yeah. One is, these quotations and points which I've been citing are not my opinion.
I understand.
As you understand
that,
I'm simply trying to bring up problems that people talk about.
I would like to comment, Mr. Goldman, on your question about indignation. I agree wholeheartedly with Father Lafarge's approach. I don't think I agree with him on the value of indignation. I think that people who become indignant at injustice, at the defiance of democratic principles, justify indignation against them. The people who become indignant at injustice are the bellwethers of progress. Without them, we more sluggish people who act on intellectual grounds do not move very fast. So that we need them both. We need both the people who flare up at injustice, who are sensitive to it, and who want to do something about it. And then the rest of us fall into line.
As long as they flare up intelligently.
Well, the people of that type are rarely intelligent according to our standards, for the reason that they're ahead of public opinion. Their judgment is usually not regarded as good because they're premature. They want to take action before the people are ready for it. But nevertheless, they are the people who establish a beachhead, it seems to me, on the shores of prejudice. And they're the shock troops. And they make it possible for the rest of us to accomplish something.
Before our time runs too far, let me pull this question of what's happening in northern cities, regardless of what's happening in southern cities, over into the area of Jewish concern over desegregation, so to speak. This is a speech by Edward Rutledge, housing director of the New York State Commission Against Discrimination. He says, "Gilded ghettos of Jews are forming in America's suburbs. These Jews have no desire for self-segregation, etc., etc. They went to the suburbs to escape. Nevertheless, the Jewish suburbs are developing in every urban area over the country, and they are largely segregated as between Jews and non-Jews." And he concludes, "Despite new state and city laws against housing discrimination, more people are living in segregated neighborhoods today than 4 years ago."
You're looking at me, Mr. Goldman?
I'm looking at anybody.
Very good. Go ahead, Mr. Ehrman. I have something to say, too, on that.
Well, I was going to suggest that while some of the results which this commentator saw are true, the causes may not be entirely what he states them to be. In all suburbs, there are not exclusionary principles. They are not applied universally. There are some bad places where there is discrimination against Jewish residents, but it is sporadic and spotty. There is another reason for this, and that is that people tend to congregate with their own. For instance, one of the great binding things is a historical religion, such as the Jewish Judaism. And they have social contacts and everything, so they just naturally trend toward living near one another. I don't think all of this is due to prejudice. Self-segregation is not an intentional thing. It's frequently a natural development.
Mr. Wilkins, you wanted to comment.
I think that's true, and I think the religious aspect of it and the building of houses of worship convenient to the... That all tends to it, much as it does with Catholics, for example. But what I was going to say is this. I think we make a mistake if in approaching this whole civil rights and human relations question, really is a question of human relations.
That's right.
If we assume that the end of it is going to be the mixing of everybody with everybody else.
Or that it even should be.
Or that it should be. Yes. This is not the point. The point is that in a democracy, you should be free to associate or not to associate as you choose. Now, when you draw lines on people because of their race or religion, you're being undemocratic. But if they choose to live together, or some of them choose to live together, and I've always said that there are tens of thousands of families in Harlem that wouldn't move out of there if you offered them the whole eastern end of Long Island. They simply wouldn't move from Harlem. They like it there, and their friends are there.
I see that we're just about 35 or 40 seconds from the end. A word, gentlemen, will it be a good year next year? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic because I seem to see a rising tide in the attitude of our own population itself. We have, during the past year, the CIOFL, the American Legion, and the Ivy League colleges all taking voluntary action to destroy segregation among their members or their students. And when begin to get voluntary action like that, you begin to get results.
Just in a word, Father LaFarge.
I would say I'm optimistic in this, because I think we have a much greater international sense, a much greater national sense.
Yes, I'm afraid I must cut off here. Sorry, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Ehrman, Father LaFarge, and Mr. Wilkins.
WRCA-TV has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind is Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Father John LaFarge, Mr. Herbert Ehrman, and Mr. Roy Wilkins. Next week, The Open Mind will discuss the coming shape of American society. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, in care of this station.